Before I get started, I'm under orders by Heath Carter to say that if you were a student or a graduate student at the University of Notre Dame, we're going to be taking a group picture up here afterwards. Go Irish. Yeah, it's real. It's real. A lot of roads run through Notre Dame. You didn't know that. But the theme I want to speak with you on today is quite straightforward. What does this historical moment require of historians? What does this historical moment require of historians? As we get started, maybe this is oversharing, but in the name of transparency, I had a devil of a time preparing for this. And if I'm honest, it's because there's a sense that I'm on the junior varsity squad and the rest of you are varsity. Because just to catch you up biographically, I defended the dissertation August 5th, 2021. And by the way, that was through a pandemic. I feel like we should all get tattoos or something if we finished a PhD in the pandemic. And on my way to finishing the doctorate, I took a position at the Center for Anti-Racist Research at Boston University, at which I worked remotely for 5 months. We were supposed to relocate to Boston, but ended up not continuing with that position. So I am, according to my name tag, an independent scholar. There we go. And it's a path I've chosen and one I embrace, and I think one that's critical for me in this moment, but it also comes with, you know, the fact that I'm not at a college or university like some of you. I'm not published in an academic press yet. And even when we talk about new scholars, what do we call them? Junior scholars. And so there's this sense of, oh, you know, it's nice that you're doing some historical stuff, but you still got another level to hit. That's a reality, but like I said, it's one that I embrace because of the historical moment I think we're in. And when I was thinking about my remarks today, I went back to what Lisa mentioned, that presentation in October 2018, which was entitled History as Activism. And I was looking at my notes and I was in this dilemma as a speaker because I'm like, I should just say the exact same thing right now, 4 years later. And then you go through the whole rigmarole. Oh, it's got to be new. It's got to be original. And it is. Don't worry. I've updated it. But if anything, what I was talking about then has become even more urgent, even more salient, even more relevant than it was in 2018. And so as I talk about the role of historians in this historic moment, what historic moment are we in? Think about what's happened since 2018. We were in the middle of the Trump presidency still, when we were getting major policy decisions via Twitter. You remember that? This was long before anything like the words coronavirus or pandemic were in the national vernacular. October 2018 was even before my first book, The Color of Compromise, was published. And think about all that's happened since then. My mind keeps going back to January 6, 2021. It's so precarious for historians to pontificate on the present. And yet, I don't think it's going too far to say that we lived through an historic moment and in some way, shape, or form, an unprecedented moment. That's a terrible word for historians to say, unprecedented. But we saw the Confederate flag being paraded through Congress. we came perilously close to the violent overthrow of our representative democracy, such as it is. There was a report that I referenced in my panel earlier today, the most comprehensive report on the role of Christian nationalism in the January 6th insurrection. I think what was most haunting about that report is all of the precursors to January 6th. There were all of these rallies and all of these meetings. You remember the Jericho March? Do you remember that not long ago, there was an attempted, a credible attempt to kidnap the governor of Michigan? To kidnap a governor. Have we paused to take stock of the historical moment that we're living in? What is our role as historians in this historical moment? I am reminded of the words of the Apostle Paul, because see, I came into history perhaps in a non-traditional manner. And I'm reminded of the words of Paul. You know, Paul was an apostle, but he was constantly trying to prove his authentic apostleship because he didn't walk with the 12 during the 3 years of Jesus' public ministry. And there's this passage in 1 Corinthians 15 where he's talking about, yeah, the resurrected Christ appeared to this group and that group and these apostles. And then to me, as though to one untimely born. It's like parents who thought they were done having kids and then, whoop, surprise. That's me. I'm 5 years younger than my nearest sibling. It's like, oh, unplanned, but wow, we're glad you're here. I kind of feel like that as a historian. I didn't go into history because I had a love for it as an undergrad. I didn't come straight out of grad school. I was in my mid-30s when I started my PhD. I was almost invariably older than my classmates, and I was the same age as many of my professors. And I came through history because I had a burden for justice. Not long ago, February 26, 2022 was the 10-year anniversary of the murder of Trayvon Martin, 10 years. And I wrote an article called The Murder of Trayvon Martin and the Death of the Evangelical Racial Reconciliation Movement. It was an interesting trip down memory lane. But I referenced that because they call folks like me who had this sort of social awakening in the 2010s, they call us the Trayvon Martin generation. And I think that's accurate to a degree because what happened was Trayvon was murdered in Sanford, Florida. About a year later, his murderer was acquitted. And it was as a result of that acquittal that Alicia Garza got on Facebook and said, "Black people, I love you, our lives matter." One of her friends who was also an activist picked that up and put a hashtag on it and said, "Black lives matter." Then it roars to the national consciousness in August 2014 when they killed a teenager named Mike Brown in a place most of us had never heard of, Ferguson, Missouri. Black people from Ferguson came out to protest the killing. The police responded with military-like force. Soon, Black Lives Matter became the banner under which the new movement, the latest wave of racial justice, marched. I read something that already by 2015, Merriam-Webster Dictionary named Black Lives Matter word of the year. And I want to take us back to that because as a relatively socially conscious person in the US, this was big, but as a Black man in the US, this was existential. You remember it was just a couple of months after that, that was the Emmanuel Nine massacre. You remember Bree Newsom then scaled the flagpole in front of the South Carolina State House, in front of which the Confederate flag still flew, and had to take it down. And got arrested. You remember Eric Garner saying, I can't breathe, 11 times. The one that really got me was Philando Castile. Because he was in the car with his girlfriend and her daughter. And I've had some very harrowing encounters with law enforcement in driving on my own. But I always thought that if I ever got pulled over and my wife and son were with me, surely I couldn't be a threat here in our Honda CRV driving up to Whole Foods or something. You know, we don't have Whole Foods in the Delta. We have to drive out of state to get there, but that's why we'd all be together as a family going to the grocery store, whatever. But they shot Philando Castile 7 times with his girlfriend and her daughter in the back. And there's this sense that Black men feel, that we know that could have been us, that the Black women in our lives know that could have been them or the men in their lives who they love. And I searched my faith for answers, and in the white Reformed and evangelical tradition I was in, I found it wanting. I found it wanting. I was trying to figure out, Ferguson, for example, how do you get a predominantly Black community being policed by a predominantly white police force? How do you have this antagonistic relationship between the community members and law enforcement that is charged to protect and serve? And I was searching around for answers. Lo and behold, historians had the most helpful things to say. I was able to read Rothstein's Color of Law and learn about redlining. I read an article on Black perspectives by an independent scholar, Carrie Lee Merritt, called One Continuous Graveyard, talking about the origins of the police force and the connection to slave patrols. I took my first graduate course in history at Jackson State University, a historically Black college under Robbie Luckett, white guy, but he really knew what he was talking about was history of the New South. I'd never even heard the term New South. We were looking post-Civil War up to the Civil Rights Movement. I read Local People by John Dittmer, and it rocked me. So I always had this sense that history and a proper understanding, a more thorough and robust understanding of the past could help us in the present. And to me, it wasn't even a question. So you can imagine my surprise when I find out that's a controversial idea. It may be controversial for some of you, I don't know. This idea of history as activism. So here's what I want to do with the rest of our time. I want to talk about four points briefly. As we talk about the role of historians in this historical moment, I think it requires, one, a reflection on why we do history. Two, it requires a reframing of the historian as activist. Three, it requires a vision for public engagement. And four, it requires courage. One is reflection on why we do history. Two, reframing the historian as activist. And three, a vision for public engagement. And lastly, courage. So reframing, a reflection on why we do history. Somebody said to me once, all history is autobiographical. All history is autobiographical, by which they meant usually historians have some personal reason for choosing the topics they study. Something happened to them, something they experienced, something they encounter, something about their identity moves them in a direction of study. And I don't know if you're an undergrad, if you're in graduate school, if you're a junior scholar, if you're got tenure, but I think we need to go back and excavate those original reasons, what brought us to history. Remember in Revelation said, you've forgotten your first love. Where did that love of history come? Where did that spark come from? And I'll bet for most of us, it coincides with some issue that requires advocacy. It coincides with some wrong that you want to be righted, with someone who was slighted that you want proper redress for. I wonder what it would spark in you to go back and review. Was it your first undergrad paper in history? Was it a thesis that you wrote? Was it a mentor that you had? I'll bet you'll find there's a little bit of activist in all of us. Secondly, it requires a reframing of the historian as activist debate. I'll be honest with you, I think it's binary and I think it's white-centered. I think it's binary and white-centered. Let me clarify some terms here. First, I don't think the issue is public engagement necessarily. Why? Because all of you want your work to be read more widely. All of you want more eyeballs on the words you've written, the research you've done, the presentations you've given. That's not really the question. The question is more about activism and advocacy. The question is about taking sides. Wearing the shirt, my own original design, justice takes sides. That's the issue. That's the issue. There's the rub. Because we know the parameters of the debate, right? It's that if you advocate for a specific position, then you've lost your credibility as objective. We're clear, though, that objectivity is nothing that we can actually achieve, pure objectivity, right? We all come with biases. Often in the current debate, this is bonus for y'all. This is just Jamar original stuff here because I like you. What I find in the debate in the public is that the people who cling most vigorously to this idea of objectivity are the ones most reluctant to examine their own biases. We all have biases. The only question is, are you clear and upfront about them or not? The other issue for me is that we are living in times of moral clarity. We are talking about issues that are pretty clear. Either masks work to reduce a virus spread or they don't. Either the election was as legitimate as it has been or it was fabricated, it was stolen. Either Black Lives Matter or they don't. Y'all, where do we stand on issues that require taking a stance? And are we so committed to preserving our image as objective historians that we refuse to take a stand on some of the most critical issues of our day? And by the way, when I went back and I said historians have the most helpful things to say, it's because they put it out there in public and weren't afraid to take a stand, or at least they didn't anyway. I wouldn't have accessed that as a non-historian. You have got such a wealth of wisdom, such a wealth of information that most people have no clue about, whatever your field. And we're in our ivory towers hoarding it to ourselves. In moments that beg and cry out for your perspective and your analysis, and you don't have to forfeit your credibility as a scholar to do so. Watch this. Because you're like, oh, Jamar's just spouting out with the mouth. Watch this. Let's do a little history here. One of the things that I said was an issue was this conversation about history as activism can be white-centered, very white-centered. So let's talk about W.E.B. Du Bois. Let's talk about Black scholars and their relationship to activism. Du Bois was all set with his Harvard PhD to simply do scholarship and wow the socks off of other academics. But something happened. There was a lynching. A lynching of a man named Sam Hose, and it altered his professional trajectory. Listen at this. I just found this. It's an interview from 1961, an audio interview for an autobiography of W.E.B. Du Bois. He dies in 63, so he's reflecting on his life. And he said to the interviewer, "I found that this Negro, Sam Hose, had been caught and lynched, and that in the meat market, which was on the way I had to pass, his fingers and toes were being exhibited. Well, I didn't deliver the letter that he was on his way to deliver. I went back to Atlanta University where he was working. And then I made up my mind that knowledge wasn't enough. That even if people were ignorant of essential matters, which they had to know, they wouldn't correct their actions without more realization of just what the difficulties were. They had not only to know, but they had to act." Du Bois goes on to say, "And so I changed from studying the Negro problem," listen at this, "from studying the Negro problem to propaganda, to letting people know just what the Negro problem meant and what the colored people were suffering and what they were kept from doing." Now, he means propaganda in an old-fashioned sense. He means advocacy. Du Bois was on his way running an errand, passed by stores that had the dismembered body parts of a lynched man, and said, "I can't just write for the Academy." He said, "I can't just do my scholarship for the sake of scholars." It was shortly after that he left Atlanta University and joined the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And listen to this. When they invited him back, they said this, "I came up in 1910 and was slated to be secretary of the NAACP, but I didn't want to be secretary because a secretary raises money and I couldn't raise money. What I wanted to do was to write and to talk." In other words, even leaving the academy, Du Bois chose not to take a higher position at the NAACP, but to retain a position that would allow him to use his scholarship to write and to speak about what he termed the Negro problem, the race problem. Do any of us question the academic rigor of W.E.B. Du Bois? Do any of us think him less of a scholar because he took a definite position in advocacy for the dignity and equity of Black people? Now, there's only one Du Bois, but the principle remains. A person who was moved and affected by his current circumstances used his scholarship for advocacy. And maybe this will help the conversation too. Perhaps there's a difference between advocacy and activism. I just Googled this. Watch this. An activist engages in direct action that leads to social change. Activism is a doctrine or practice that emphasizes direct, vigorous action, especially in support of or opposition to one side of a controversial issue. These are the people marching. They're the heads of activist organizations. They're on the front lines. And so maybe when you hear a historian as activist, that's what you're thinking. But there's also something called an advocate, which says this: an advocate listens to and amplifies others. Advocacy is the act of supporting, defending, or arguing for a specific cause or issue. Activism, more direct; advocacy, amplifying. Maybe you're more comfortable with historian as advocate. I actually don't think that solves the problem for you, though. Because with both an activist and an advocate, you have to take sides. you still have to take sides. But since this is the conference on faith and history, maybe we can add another element to it. Historian as activist, historian as advocate, historian as witness. Historian as witness. Witnesses share what they have seen and heard when matters of justice are being decided. Witnesses share what they have seen and heard when matters of justice are being decided. And so we need context. We need more information. We need an in-depth analysis on an issue of justice. And this is where historians can come in. We witness to what we have studied, what we have researched, what we found in the archives, what we've thought deeply about, what we've conversed about, what we've gone to conferences about, and bring them to bear on issues of justice. Is that controversial? I'm going to keep doing it. Anyway, thirdly, what this historical moment requires of historians is a vision for public engagement. I'm thinking specifically of the Conference on Faith and History now. I was looking at the website and there's this vision statement or statement of purpose that says, the Conference on Faith and History is a community of scholars exploring the relationship between Christian faith and history. We welcome members from a variety of Christian traditions around the world. We also seek to learn from scholars outside the Christian tradition. And it says, our primary goal is to encourage excellence in the theory and practice of history from the perspective of historic Christianity. We are both scholars and people of faith. And what difference does that make is all I'm asking. We are both scholars and people of faith, but what difference does it make? What difference does it make for the Conference on Faith and History? What difference does it make for the CFH in 2022? What would be a vision for public engagement for this body? I think we could all put our heads together for 5 minutes at our tables and come up with some pretty exceptional stuff. But just to prime the pump, some of the things I think of, podcasts are easy and public. Talking with any one of you for 30 seconds about your research makes me want to learn more. And you can easily connect that to current events without ever writing a word down. So you don't have to worry about what people are going to write about you. Well, they still write about you, but you don't have to worry about what you've written and they're going to write about you. A vision for public engagement. You know, this is in many ways a conference that I feel very at home at because I'm a person who tries to be very outspoken about his faith as well as a historian. But as it says in Revelation, I have this one thing against you. Where are all the black folks? We got a few. I'm seeing y'all. Thank you. I'm glad you're here. But we have to be honest about the fact that historically and up to the present day, racial and ethnic diversity has not been extra prevalent. So whatever happened before, what are we going to do moving forward? Many people will say, well, there's a supply side issue. There's just not enough black historians. Well, I think the existence of something like the African American Intellectual Historical Society would argue against that. I think as well, if there is a pipeline issue, then we're not powerless to create scholarships and mentorships and pathways into this discipline for historically underrepresented groups. What's stopping us? Partnerships with other historical organizations or even advocacy organizations. And here's the thing that'll be real controversial, even though it's just probably a piece of paper, prudent and judicious public statements about certain issues. So we're in this time when there's an attack on the accurate telling of history. That's what this anti-critical race theory crusade is about. It's about dismantling this idealized and valorized image of the past by telling a truer story. And it's about the resistance to that effort. What do we as historians have to say in this moment? I think you could have a very moderated, well-reasoned statement that says, we're pro-history. There are literal bills being considered in state legislatures banning books. Have we as scholars, as people of the academy, as intellectuals, nothing to say on that? Here's my concern, folks. As I wrote books like The Color of Compromise, what I saw most often was not this group of people who was wearing robes and hoods and burning crosses. It's people who were silent. And I'm envisioning 30 years from now, historians looking back at this moment, should the Lord tarry that long and we survive, 30 years from now, looking back at this moment, and somebody coming across the Conference on Faith and History and is like, nothing about the insurrection, nothing about critical race theory, opposition to history, nothing about Black Lives Matter, nothing about justice, nothing about truth. We're living through a crisis of epistemology right now, where that which is true is being labeled as fake news, where because of the media and social media ecosystems, we can have people living in completely separate information bubbles. So that the truth that you've spent years researching is simply dismissed. I just wonder what your answer would be to this question. As a historian, what do you want your witness to be? As a historian, what do you want your witness to be? And lastly, I'll close with this. What this historical moment requires of historians is courage. Courage. Going back to Du Bois, there was a portion of that interview that I didn't share, but I'll do it now. He talks about why he left Atlanta University, and it wasn't simply because he got this other job offer that was a pull factor. There were also push factors. He said this, "I was practically compelled to make this change because the people who were supporting Atlanta University were a little uneasy about the way in which I talked about the Negro problem. And pressure began to be put upon the university to do without my services." He's so dignified. Pressure began. "I had begun to criticize Booker T. Washington, saying it wasn't enough to teach Negroes trades. The Negroes had to have some voice in their government. They had to have protection in the courts. They had to have trained people to lead them. Well, all this together put such pressure on Atlanta University that at last I resigned. I mean, they would have had to drop me if they wanted to keep the philanthropic gifts that were coming from the rich people of the North." You ever had somebody threaten or actually stop giving money because of the way you talked about certain issues? Certainly happens with race a lot of times. Many of you are at colleges and universities where you have boards of trustees and alumni that are very conservative on these issues. And if you say the wrong thing or invite the wrong speaker or write the wrong thing, well, the first thing that happens is they threaten to withdraw the donation. Well, you're in good company with Du Bois. They did the same thing to him. Said if he keeps talking so directly and forthrightly about this issue, we're no longer going to financially support your institution. And the same could happen to you. I feel the burden to at least give a word of caution about this. If in our zeal for righteousness, we go out, but we're not prepared for what's going to come back. The research I'm working on right now studies resistance to racism from a Christian perspective, but right alongside that resistance is a backlash. Are we not seeing it now? With an attempted insurrection, with a crusade against critical race theory, a crusade against history, as backlash to a historic uprisings for racial justice in 2020, going even further, some have said a backlash against having the first Black president. What I'm trying to warn you and give you a word of caution about is if you are on board with being a witness in this moment, being an advocate or an activist in this moment, it's going to be costly. I'm reminded of Jesus' words on the Sermon on the Mount. He said, God blesses those who are persecuted for doing right, for the kingdom of heaven is there. Goes on to say, God blesses you when people mock you and persecute you and lie about you and say all sorts of evil things against you because you're my followers. Be happy about it. Be very glad. For great is the reward that awaits you in heaven. And remember, the ancient prophets were persecuted in the same way. I like how another translation puts it. You're blessed when your commitment to God provokes persecution. The persecution drives you even deeper into God's kingdom. And so if you're going to be an advocate, if you're going to be an activist, if you're going to be a witness as a historian in this historical moment, expect a form of persecution. Now, we know there's a spectrum of persecution. We know we got brothers and sisters globally who couldn't gather together as Christians without being threatened by their very lives. There's a spectrum. But the text also says that it includes when people lie about you and mock you and say all sorts of evil things against you. Listen to this. I spoke at a Christian college 2 years ago, y'all. Folks can hold a grudge. This was in 2020 I spoke. And as a result of my chapel message there, there was a petition written in protest of my presence and my words. And it said, last school year, this Christian college hosted a chapel presentation by Jamar Tisby, an outspoken apologist for CRT. Can we put that on the name tag next time? I mean, it's news to me. I never studied critical race theory, but hey. Then they paid me a compliment and they didn't know it because in the very next sentence, it says, a staff member also used a talk by Brian Stevenson, a CRT defender and founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, to teach on the biblical concept of mercy. The gall. By the way, if you've got a problem with Brian Stevenson, it ain't his problem. Like, this man is literally getting unjustly convicted people off of death row. His presentations are all stories. He's not polemical at all, except in saying, you know, we shouldn't kill people. But that too is considered off limits at a Christian college. Went on to say that there was a freshman at my chapel presentation who messaged a member of our group, the group that wrote this petition, and said that he was troubled by my presentation. He asked what steps could be taken to stop the spread of CRT on campus. Oh, I promise you, it's coming your way. I was at another Christian college, and in response again to a set of messages I gave at chapel, somebody who wasn't even there, it was an alumni or alumnus or an older person who was watching online, wrote an article in response to my message, said, Jesus can set you free from the yoke of being woke. Points for rhyming, you know, it's creative. Said, Mr. Tisby says that contemporary Christians are guilty of the same sins of racism in the past. That's a heavy burden to bear. How does Mr. Tisby suggest that we deal with this burden? He says that we need to be engaged in civil rights activism in the pursuit of racial justice. In other words, we need to be sufficiently woke. In effect, he sets up a penitential system in which people can keep making satisfaction for their intrinsically racist tradition by living as extremists for love, quote from King. Those who engage in this system of penance and are promised special blessings, especially if their zeal for the cause provides opposition and earns them labels like Marxists and social justice warriors. It was something. All I'm saying is, whatever the cause, whatever the field, If you stand for truth, justice, and righteousness in a context that's bent against those things, you can expect resistance. You can expect people to lie about you. You can expect angry emails. You can expect people to threaten to rescind their donations. And what this moment requires of us, I think more than anything, is courage. Here's what I love about Jesus. The longer I do this work, the more it comes back to me, to Jesus. So this is a conference on faith and history, so I can preach a little bit, right? My point being this. Whenever Jesus promises persecution, he attaches it to another promise, the promise of his presence. Oh, y'all not going to get through this with your faith intact, with your families intact, with your emotions intact, if you don't cling to God's unchanging hand. What I can guarantee you is that you will, on some level, face rejection from the community that you thought was your own. You will, on some level, face ostracization and distancing because they will view you as radical. They will put labels on you like CRT or Marxist or social justice warrior, whatever the latest label might be. And in that moment, you're going to question your stance. You're going to question your call, and you're going to say, did I do the right thing? Are they right? Am I on the right track? And all I can tell you is keep holding on to Jesus' hand. Once you find yourself in the midst of this work, there's all this stuff in the Bible that Jesus said that sounded real nice, sounded real good, sounded real pretty, but wasn't real to you till you started taking real steps in the direction of justice. Y'all, I'm not up here because I want to sell books. I'm not up here because I want more followers on Twitter or social media. I'm up here because I'm compelled by the power of Christ who came down from heaven to earth to become one of us in the muck and the mire because he wanted justice for us, because he came to set the captives free, because he wanted us to be liberated physically and spiritually in all kinds of ways. It ain't either or, it's both and. Can we get a sense of that? Can we be the leaders of that as people of faith who are also historians? Can we bring that history to bear? History ain't nothing but truth. And somewhere it said, the truth will set you free. So we gonna set some people free or not, and we gonna set ourselves free or not. And what I can tell you is, ain't everybody gonna get free. Why? Because it's hard. It's hard. It's hard. But the only thing that keeps you going, the only thing that keeps you going is Jesus. Oh, Lord, when you get a hold of Jesus, he already got a hold of you. When you get in that moment, Martin Luther King had the kitchen table moment. About a month into the Montgomery bus boycott, he had just gotten another call saying, if you aren't out of town in the next 3 days, we're going to blow up you and your family. Went to the kitchen, he got himself a cup of coffee, and he sat down. It's midnight. He said, Lord, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I have the strength to do this. And he said, I heard a voice from God saying, Martin, stand up, be strong. You got to take hold of the faith that your father and your mother taught you, and you got to make it your own. Brothers and sisters, what does this historical moment require of historians? Historians who are Christian, it requires of you to take hold of the faith for yourself, to feel that it is so real that it can get you through whatever opposition, backlash, or confrontation is coming your way. Because one thing I cannot guarantee is that you'll get out of this hole. I can't guarantee that you'll keep your job. I can't guarantee that you will stay at your church. I can't guarantee that you will keep your same group of friends and associates and colleagues. What I can guarantee is that Jesus will keep you. Amen.